Well, good evening. It's a real pleasure to see so many people turning up this evening. Real pleasure to know there's a radio club around the place that has so many attendees. I presume it's like this at every meeting. If it's like my club, that may not necessarily be the case. But we haven't noted that in amateur radio there is a reduction of membership. And Ken Morgan asked me to make my view on that comment just before we start, because I'm not so sure that I'm one of the naysayers who go around saying this is necessarily a bad thing. Amateur radio has always been in the forefront of innovation. We like to think that back at the turn of the last century, when new ideas were being developed, many of them were developed by amateur radio people. A small, relatively exclusive group of people who experimented and developed new ideas and brought those ideas to fruition, resulting very greatly in the broadcast and television facilities that we have today and the communication facilities that we all enjoy. AMSAT is no stranger to this. We have again developed many ideas within the small satellite area, which again are right at the forefront of many of the satellite techniques and ideas that we have developed and are being used by many governments around the world, and also many of the television people who are now beaming down their pictures to you and charging you exorbitant amounts of whatever to receive them. However, they are, of course, a very good source of spare parts and equipment for amateurs as well. So we won't decry them too much, because they can be extremely helpful at the right price. I thought tonight we'd take a look at AO40. Where it is, what's happened to it, and just to give you some idea, again, although this satellite is again rather at the forefront of satellites, it is probably the last one that will be built to this size. It was a great idea back in 1990 when we thought about what we're going to build next. We built Phase 3A, which we like to think of as in geosync orbit, sync as in 120 feet under the Atlantic Ocean. It keeps perfect time with the rest of the world. Phase 3B, which is up there, and in fact landed, had a little bit of a collision and a propulsion problem, is actually not in the planned orbit, but is still operating. Whenever the sun hits its solar cells just beautifully, anybody who wants to have a good conversation with an elliptical orbit satellite, AO10 is up there just waiting for you. And who's worked it here? Hey, great. Well done. Yeah. And then there was Phase 3C, my favorite of the Phase 3 satellites, which was out in an elliptical orbit. Had we got the first experience of being really able to use S-band as a receiving band from Phase 3C, and that satellite put out less than a watt ERP, like 40,000 kilometers out, and came in like an FM receiver would on a broadcast station. It was absolutely beautiful. People came into my shack and said, "That can't be a satellite, it's too damn good." It really was excellent. Unfortunately, in 1995, Phase 3C felt the tug of gravity from the Earth and the Moon and the Sun and decided that it was time to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And we had a great time with all sorts of people predicting when exactly that satellite was going to go through, enter the Earth's atmosphere and die. I think the most best person's estimate was James Miller, G3RUH, who got it within, who predicted it within something like an hour or less. And He was absolutely true to form. Then, of course, we had AO 40. AO 40, yes, it took us too long to build it. It is too big in size. It's too complex. And we've had some failures with it. Now, my question is it a success or is it a failure? I'm going to leave the answer to that to you, because I think from an Australian viewpoint, you might get a very different answer than, for example, from a North American viewpoint. For example, if I can just mention one thing, that AO40 was originally planned to have very poor reception in Australia. It now has very good reception in Australia. So that might change the whole project right from there on in. Okay, let's take a look at it and see what I've got here. The main features, AO40. We've never been able to work the 21 megahertz because we lost the omnidirectional antennas, and we'll come as to why we lost those later on. But the 24 gigahertz works just fine. Really does work well, and I've seen a demonstration of it work in up at the Surrey AMSAT last summer, and it really gave a very nice performance. The high gain antennas on there, generally speaking, are working fairly well. The receivers are sensitive. Now, the 600 watt power budget, let me explain that a little more, is only 600 watts when we have got the solar cells opened up. As at the moment, they are totally wrapped around the satellite. It's a six-sided satellite. We've got six solar panels, and they're still wrapped around there. The reason for which we'll get into. Originally, it was due to have a high inclination elliptical orbit, and was meant to be exactly repeatable every 48 hours. Due to the propulsion problems that we've had with it, it no longer has a high inclination elliptical orbit. It is an orbit plus or minus 6 degrees of the equator, which means that Australia can receive it just fine. The weight of that satellite was 632 kilograms. Now, you'll notice the Americans who actually put up these haven't quite got sorted out the difference between weight, metric, and dimensions, feet. You heard the story of the Mars lander. However, I think most of the people in this room are probably bilingual, as we say in Canada, with feet and metric, so we'll use the units that are there. Diameter is 7.5 feet. And when the wings are set out, i.e. the solar cells are deployed in a straight line, then it is approximately 20 feet across the solar cells. There is, or will be, three-axis stabilization to hold it with the antennas facing towards the Earth. At the moment, it is held that way by rotating the satellite spin rotation. And it does manage to keep the satellite antennas generally pointing towards the Earth. When I say spinning it, that's like 2 or 3 RPM. There's a look at it. And up there is a picture of Lou McFadden on the left-hand side. In the middle of the two at the back is Stan Wood. He's the VP of Engineering for AMSAT NA. And we have two gentlemen there who were contract employees. At one time, we had to employ contract employees so we could get it finished in time. But it's a six-sided box. In the middle are the propulsion. And you can see the big horn at one end, and there's another one at the underside. Those are the propulsion rockets. Around the top face, as you are looking at it, here are the various antennas. The long bars, for example, three of them are loop antennas, which are 2 meter antennas. The dish at the right hand side is the 1.2 L-band antenna, and that has that was interesting. We were wondering what to get for the right dish, and one day Stan Wood was up in the Montreal area of Canada, and he saw what he thought was the right cake pan, and believe me, it worked extremely well as a dish. The actual one there isn't the cake pan, but all the trials and rough estimates and so on were done using the cake pan, which worked. That is an almost exact model of it. It's not that we're cheap, we're trying to be inexpensive. One of the features of the whole of satellite work is that temperatures where we are generally trying to operate are influenced by light and darkness. The light side of the temperatures being, of course, the sun. The dark side being anything that isn't facing the sun, such as the dark side of the AO40. Or if you're going through perigee at night and it's a low perigee, then the Earth's shadow will cast a shadow and things will cool down. Interestingly enough, our biggest problem with AO40, even though it goes way out in space, is to keep it cool. And we have an expert, Dick Jansen, WD4FAB, who does all our solar and heat and thermal analysis. And we really found that with this one, we had to put, even at the last minute, we kept calculating and recalculating, at the last minute, we had to put on a set of solar blankets to actually try and keep this thing cooler. Because even out in space, it was getting pretty darn warm. In the middle of the device, we have right here a set of heat pipes filled with anhydrous ammonia. And they go right round the inside of the satellite. And they take heat from one side, where the anhydrous ammonia boils off, and take it to the dark side, where the anhydrous ammonia cools down again, releasing the heat out into space. You'll notice there's no fans. Why? There's no air. We can only use two methods of getting rid of the heat: conduction and radiation. So everything has to be done by transporting heat from the hot side to the cool side. That includes the finals, and those heat pipes, four of them, are planned to run close, just behind the wall where the finals of all the final transmitters are. So they pick up heat there, again, dump it over to the cold side. The four or six round objects immediately above the heat pipes are the fuel tanks. And that fuel, hydrazine, is the main fuel that we have there. It's so corrosive that a drop of hydrazine will eat just about any metal, any plastic. The one thing that it seems to be fairly immune with is I don't tip of my tongue a second ago. Teflon. It seems just Teflon is the one thing that seems to be able to resist it. Now that's a great saving, because one of the problems we had with some hydrazine spill. And nearly all of our cables and so on are covered with Teflon. Here you see, particularly in the center of the top, the propellant flow assembly regulating the hydrazine to the engine, rocket engine. Also, we're providing nitrous oxide as an oxidizer for it. The two mixed together and give a really enormous jet. 400 newtons, I think it was. The problem that we ran into, one of the valves at the actual motor, rocket motor, stuck. As a result of that sticking, we ultimately landed up in a situation where both the hydrazine and the nitrous oxide came in contact with one another in a spot where they were not meant to, i.e. in one of the tubes. We thought we had a major explosion on board. We thought we had disintegrated the complete satellite into minute pieces. And about 3 days, all we could do was weep. And found that there was one piece of metal up there, and it wasn't 1,000 pieces as we had thought, but what had happened was it was one piece, and after a lot of experimentation, New Zealander 02AOX found that he could activate one of the transmitters, the 2.4 gigahertz transmitter. And therefore, and she was taking signals up on 70 centimeters, and we had an active satellite again. Now, he found that on what, for the rest of the world, was December the 25th, but for Australia and New Zealand, I think you were all on Boxing Day. But I'll tell you, it was the happiest Christmas that amateurs around the world have had for a long year.